because this samsara is without a noble beginning. A first point is not discerned of beings roaming and wandering on, obscured by ignorance and bound by craving. What do you think, bhikkhus, which is more? The water in the four great oceans, or the flow of the blood that you have shed when your head was chopped off, while roaming and wandering on through this long course? So, and then they reply, Venerable Sir, as we understand the Dhamma taught by the Blessed One, the flow of the blood that we have shed when our head was chopped off while roaming and wandering on, this alone is more than all the water in the four great oceans. Good, good, bhikkhus. It's good that you understand my teaching in this way. And then he goes on, for a long time you've been cows, and the flow of blood you've shed when your head was chopped off as a cow is more than all the water in the four great oceans. And then for a long time you've been buffalo, rams, goats, sheep, chicken, pigs. For a long time you've been bandits arrested for raiding villages, highway robbery or adultery, and the flow of blood you've shed when you were beheaded as a bandit is more than all the water in the four great oceans. So why is that? This samsara is without a noble beginning. The first point is not discerned of beings roaming and wandering on, obscured by ignorance and bound by craving. This is enough to become disillusioned, or they translate disenchanted, or I think fed up, is kind of dispassionate and liberated in regard to all sankharas, all determinations. So those bhikkhus delighted in the Blessed One's words, and then it adds, while this teaching was being given, the minds of the 30 bhikkhus from Pava were liberated from defilement, so they became an arahant. So I suppose one sort of question is that might not be immediately obvious why just reflecting on this point would kind of be sufficient for somebody to like completely free their mind from craving entirely.
Yeah, so the if you look at the nature of what was described, the nature of that samsara, it's kind of obvious that it boils down to like just incessant repetition. You could even get a glimpse of that in this life. If you have to go through something over and over again, repeatedly, how disenchanting it becomes. Even stuff that you actually voluntarily engage with or want or even had the desire for. Take the desire for some sensual pleasure and repeat it long enough and you will be sick of it. So nothing has actually changed. Like, it's still the same sense object, still the same experience, still the same pressure it exhibits, still the same. The whole thing is the same, yet simply going through it a few times, you don't want it anymore. So understanding, or rather seeing then your entire existence, everything that you ever been through, everything that you ever would go through, as just one of the basically instances of that endless repetition, it gives this thorough context of complete disenchantment with anything that can come your way, good or bad, doesn't matter. You're just like, it's not worth it. Obviously, that's in theory, kind of can be clear, but you can then ask a question, so why then it was enough back then for that teaching, for that comparison to be enough for complete freedom from passion and becoming arahants, and today is not enough to even become a sotapanna for people, even if they hear it, even if they understand it, even if they can see the point of it, they're not free even from the first three fetters, let alone all the fetters. So where's the difference?
Virtue,
the level of virtue, but virtue taken rightly. So
they were all
authenticity, difference in authenticity as well. Responsibility for one's mind states, actions, choices, which basically it was more or less the norm back then. It was certainly more normal more average than it is today. So today people will need to make a lot of effort to just become like those unenlightened Putujanas of the olden days of the Buddha's time. So far from being more advanced, we are simply more proliferated, more drifted away from certain basic phenomenological truths. Yeah. So when those monks, although they were not free, when they heard this comparison, when they got the context, they realized the depth of it, and their minds were freed. There was nothing that they wanted, nothing that they remained clinging to or adhering to or assuming as theirs. Because even see that experience of this is mine, but this is mine, this is close to me. How many times have you been through that in this life? Let alone if you expand that infinitely in both directions. There's absolutely nothing, no single experience worth desiring, engaging, adhering to, possessing, protecting. Because that's also a thing, see, like the things you have to protect, God as yours, to maintain yourself, your possessions, people, your ownerships, things that are dear to you, things that offer you safety. You just need to, how many times you've been through that again?
One thing that just kind of what I was thinking about in regards to this was that, you know, you can sort of see this principle of repetition on many different scales or in many different ways. Like it kind of, even in terms of how, you know, how people sometimes speak about the world or society in these kind of absolute terms, as though what's going on now were something sort of a final importance, or as though there was some kind of progress from the past.
Mm.
Oh, now we live in a great time of great turmoil and social upheaval and whatever, as though that is something new.
Mm.
Or like, you know, now there's great progress being made in this direction or that direction, as though there's some sort of like progression through even history or whatever. But if you look, you know, there's never been a time, there's always going to be a war, there's always people being oppressed, there's always slavery of some kind, there's always constantly just repeating in different versions of the same thing. And then you look, okay, what do I want to do in my life? You know, what do I want to kind of contribute to, just generally as a person asking a question? What do I want to actually, what should I do?
Where do I want to
make
a difference?
Where do I want to make an effort? Where do I want to make a difference? What do I want to contribute to?
Mm.
Who can I help anybody?
Yeah. And would my effort go to waste? Because, like, if you want to make a difference on just and change one of the versions of events that are repeating throughout the history and people's decisions and everything else, you realize, well, that would be a wasted effort.
Exactly.
So how about I try and make the effort where things won't get repeated?
Yeah. And you see that, like,
the root.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's the root of it all. And you see, like, okay, like for that one, the how many times has your head been cut off? And look, think about like all of the beings that are getting their heads cut off, in the world now. Like, and all of those people who are cutting off their heads are guaranteeing that that same thing will continue repeating again.
Mm.
They will get their heads cut off.
Mm.
And it's like those, you kind of see it as, okay, it's not just kind of this thing that's outside that's going on that I'm just sort of in. I'm the one perpetuating it. I'm the one doing it. These beings are the ones doing it.
And what's the main reason for everybody perpetuating it, being part of it, and suffering the consequences? What's the soul factor that unites them all? What's the root of it all, basically?
Craving. Or
More practically, what's the reason for killing, stealing, falling out, fighting, cheating, lying?
Being touched by pain.
Sensual desire.
Greed.
Desire. Desire, basically.
Greed.
It's root of all the,
what keeps it churning? What keeps it
moving? If people say, even if people were not necessarily enlightened and free from craving and understood Four Noble Truths, if people were free from desires, there would be no problems in the world.
Mm.
So desire is the reason people kill, kill animals, kill each other. So you can you know, you can prevent, you can conquer, you can legislate, you can shift the culture. Fundamentally, you're just changing the versions of it. You can fight the slavery, you can change the society, but for as long as you yourself are acting with the desire, you are contributing to the same repetition of things not really going anywhere, just changing its form but remaining the same.
And if you see the kind of the root cause, that it's desire that's causing all these problems, then you can see that me giving food to all these people, changing the government and so on, well, are these people going to change their desires? Are they going to?
No.
So then what is the point of me doing that? You know, it can only help so much. You can't get so passionate about, you know, change on that level, because it's,
well, like, that's the thing, like, people get passionate, exactly, and they realize, you realize that even if it's a change for a better set of circumstances, it's a change that's that you are aiming for. It, you're aiming it because you want to fulfill your desire, which means that is the principle you follow, that's the principle that you're not uprooting. So when somebody else comes with a different set of desires, they will feel equally justified in following their principle of, well, but this is my desire, this is what I want. And then you will clash. Sooner or later, it has to happen. Things cannot go smoothly because everybody takes their desire and for granted and feels justified about it.
Maybe that if you can show someone this is the problem, you know, if you can point out that desire is the problem. You know, how many people are willing to give that up?
Well, exactly. In order to see that desire is a problem, you need to at least to some degree start questioning your own desires, even if they seem good. And that's the thing. That's why it's like a blindness. Intoxicated by sensuality means you don't see the problem of your desires. Fundamentally, you don't see a problem of having any desires. You might say, oh, this desire is a problem, but this other one isn't. This is a good desire. But fundamentally, you need to start questioning even that and recognize, well, desire in itself, simply by having the nature of pressuring me, being under its influence, losing perspective on account of it, not being able to remain unmoved by the force of desire, by always having to like suffer on account of saying no to it, suffer if I don't get enough of it, and all of that, it should be seen as a problem. But that requires a reflection. So that's why if somebody is not even willing to think that way, you telling them the root of all of the problems is a desire, not the state of the world, they're not going to hear that, because their desire will say, no, you're wrong, because that's not what I want. But that's what the Buddha said, like himself, that the mothers fight with fathers, with sons, with daughters, kings with kings, and everybody on account of sensuality, taking up rods, sticks, beating each other, killing others, harming others. Just, it's all because sooner or later those desires will be coming from different directions with different aims, and we can't all have what we want. Or sometimes people want what we have, or what we want, somebody else doesn't want that, so they have a desire against it. So again, it's going to be, you know, the famous simile of the mango tree. You climb up to eat the mangoes at the top, but somebody who can't climb the tree but wants the mangoes, he'll find his means of getting them by cutting the tree, and then getting the mangoes from the ground while you're still in the tree. So that's the thing, like, you're committed to certain ways because of your desires, but somebody else comes sort of perpendicular to that with their own set of desires and ways, and you're just in the way. Or certain parts of your life are in his way. So, and that's it. That's all it takes.
Yeah. How many people, the desires are the same? Everyone wants the same thing. Maybe we can all just want the same thing.
Yeah, that's impossible. That's like let's all
nations.
There will be like 1,000 people throwing a dice, and every single one of them getting the same number on a dice. You can imagine it, but practically that is absolutely completely impossible. It cannot occur.
You could say probably that what's uniting is that everyone wants to have pleasure.
Yeah.
But that's in the same way dividing things.
Exactly. So it's like, oh, but what's pleasant for me, it's not pleasant for you, and that's already going to be a conflict there if we come into each other's way. Yeah. So in order to understand desire as the problem, as the fuel for this whole samsara and perpetual kind of repetition of everything and nothing, really. You need to have already had this moment, have to have some authenticity and recognize that it doesn't matter if your desire is good or bad on the surface, presence of desire is bad. It's unbeneficial for you, for others, for both. That's where it's said that the Arahant practices for the welfare of others, not by going and feeding them or, as I said, changing the society, by removing the desire in his experience, completely uprooting it. That is beneficial for him, beneficial for everybody that interacts with him. There will be no conflict of interest or whatsoever, because he has no interest left. And plus, of course, he's able to, he would have understood it, and he's able to convey to somebody else that wants to hear it. So factually, by uprooting the desire in your own experience, you are making samsara a better place for one being less, basically. One being less affected by desire, it's factually better. That is, because that's the level that matters. That's the level of samsara's fuel, to put it that way. Even if so miraculously, there's a king and he changes the culture of his country and gets everybody on the same page about everything, and everybody wants the same thing. Again, fantasy, utopian idea. But say, abstractly, imagine it as something, still, there's no difference in samsara.
Yep.
There is no difference because everybody is still bound by the same fuel, bound by the same thread of central desire.
But as you have to want the thing that's actually going to bring everyone together, which is non-desire, non-delight in the world.
Which is a desire, yeah.
Non-desire for sensuality. So it's like you have to want the same thing, which... If everyone wants the same thing, it has to be the thing which unites everyone.
Right.
Which makes everyone arahants. Yeah. Which
and what cannot ever unite everyone is the objects of their sense desires. Because that's the variety of sense objects is the kind of what incites the desire. And see, as we said, as we started this, even if you have a desire towards certain sense objects, repeat it a few times and you will lose the desire for it. You'll move on to something else. You're not going to uproot the desire. It's just desire will move on to something else. So even within yourself, it's impossible to always want the same object of your desire. Let alone now when you introduce 1,000 more beings and it's inconceivable. That's what I mean. Like when you yourself cannot sustain desire for one object just equally with the same degree, impossible, because it's not in your control to begin with. So yes, exactly. Then you recognize, well, everybody has a desire. So if everybody would want to be free from desire, that could be a common value. But again, that would come out of a desire at the time. And as such, impossible for everybody to want to be free from desires. That's what we said, there are four types of people. Some don't even need to hear the teaching. They'll figure where the problem is and free themselves. But then on the other end of that spectrum, you have those that the Buddha himself can be teaching, and it's like flogging the dead horse. It will make no difference whatsoever. They will not hear it, nor want to hear it, nor want to make the effort. Because if you did, you would, more often than not, you would wish to not have desire at all. Because see, I have this pressing desire, and I have to go and work, and earn, and fight for things that I want, and protect them. And you might do it once, twice, but it's exhausting, it's tiring. Would it be nice if I could just be left at peace, and not even have this pressure that's forcing me to act, and so on. Slave to your own desires.
But even being able to recognize what you just described, that's the beginning of understanding of the issue.
Of your situation, yeah.
But even that, that's exactly the thing. It's even on that level, you can see internally the same, again, how you're just
same repetition,
repeating, trying to solve the problem. Let me just kind of do this work and find, okay, I have to do it. But kind of, even as you're doing it, that all you're doing is perpetuating exactly the same thing. Kind of reminded me of that, what you were saying the other day as well, about the debt, just getting another.
Oh yeah, borrowing from here
to pay back there. And literally, all you're doing is perpetuating the state of debt. Different versions, different kinds of debt from different people.
Yeah.
But it's the same.
It's still
debt.
Under the same debt.
Exactly. Yeah. Again and again, and every time you act out of desire, it's that. It doesn't matter even how coarse or how subtle, it's that exact same thing. You're just perpetuating the same thing. So it's... And that's samsara in itself as well.
Yeah.
Become fed up, really, of that. It's not... that's why you can become free of it here and now. Even, you know, you don't necessarily need to remember all of the past lives or anything. It's just that nature of repeating the same thing in different versions. And
but it kind of boils down to that. Basically, sensual desire manifests itself. It's unpleasant. In its core, you feel the pain. You don't want to deal with it there and then, so you act out to relieve the pain, knowing it will come back because you didn't really address it. So it's just procrastinating, postponing, delaying, putting it off, and becoming completely hooked and addicted to that, the distraction that comes out of that mode of being. But even then, and then, even there and then, you could, and deep down you know that the only reason you want sense objects of pleasure is because it's painful to not go for them. So not having them, it's painful, and that's why you act out, because you don't want to deal with the pain. Just like any addiction, exactly the same. You know, you can even know how harmful it is and how everything is falling apart as a result of it. But still, when that pain touches you, you choose to turn a blind eye and go for the distraction instead of addressing it, instead of being able to, well, to say no to it.
And you know as well, like, that's the other difference I think it makes in just having this perspective of samsara generally. It's the same thing. It's like when you're an addict, you kind of are aware that the pressure of the addiction that you feel now is nothing other than the result of you
having given in into number it of times,
and
again
and again and again. Like, that's literally your inheritance.
So if you then don't give in,
you know,
for a period of time, you know that the pressure will have to lessen.
Exactly. And that's the difference it makes, I think, when you realize, okay, this entire situation that I'm in, or any kind of suffering I could experience, or any suffering that any being is experiencing, is his inheritance, and fundamentally.
Yeah.
So, I've inherited this situation of pain, of suffering, and all what I need to do is stop fueling it, stop adding to it.
Yeah. Inherited debt.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
From yourself.
From yourself.
Yeah, of course. Exactly. Yeah. There's no first point before which you were debtless, and then you incurred it, but yeah.
Inheritance plus taxes.
Always, yeah. Yeah, it's kind of, it's the interest rate is growing.
Yes.
Yeah, it's not a static thing.
Mm. Yeah, either you're paying it off or accruing it
more, yeah.